There's no doubt in my mind that this short series on tough love is one we all need to hear. People are hard to love. They're prickly, they're abrasive, they're messy. They can cause a pile of grief, effort, and heartache. If we were simply to add up all the benefits and compare it to all the negatives of being in relationship with people, if we added up all the pluses and subtracted all the disadvantages, we'd find ourselves swimming in a sea of red relationship ink. It just would not be worth it. It doesn't pay off to love some people. It costs us big time to love and care for some people. Parents know this. You know that they don't pay off. Look, I don't care how much you love your toddler. It's not paying off. It's not paying off yet. Maybe somewhere down the road when you're old and feeble, they'll care for you and they'll change your diapers or something like that. But for the most part, it doesn't pay off to love a 14-year-old snotty girl. I had four of them. I know. So the question that's begging to be asked is, why do we bother loving people? Why do we bother to love those people who sometimes are so difficult? Well, for a Christ follower, there's little question that God expects us to love even the most difficult people. Matthew chapter 5, verses 43 to 48 says, "You have heard the law that says, love your neighbors and hate your enemy. But I say, love your enemies, pray for those who persecute you. And that way you will be acting as true children of your Father in heaven, for he gives his sunlight to both the evil and the good, and he sends rain on the just and the unjust alike. If you love only those who love you, what reward is there for that? Even corrupt tax collectors do that much. If you are kind only to your friends, how are you different from anyone else? Even pagans do that. But you are to be perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect." It's clear that God expects us to love difficult people. Look at Luke chapter 6, verses 27 to 36. It says something very similar. "But to you who are willing to listen, I say, love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who hurt you. If someone slaps you on one cheek, offer the other cheek also. If someone demands your coat, offer your shirt also. Give to anyone who asks, and when things are taken away from you, don't try to get them back. Do to others as you would like them to do to you. If you love only those who love you, why should you get credit for that? Even sinners love those who love them. And if you do good only to those who do good to you, why should you get credit? Even sinners do that much. And if you lend money only to those who can repay you, why should you get credit? Even sinners will lend to other sinners for a full return. Love your enemies, do good to them, lend to them without expecting to be repaid. Then your reward from heaven will be very great, and you will truly be acting as children of the Most High. For he is kind to those who are unthankful and wicked. You must be compassionate, just as your Father is compassionate." The scripture is making reference to some Hebrew laws. Hebrew laws from the Old Testament. These Old Testament laws were the framework for the culture for the nation of Israel. They had a lot to do with how people would get along and coexist as a nation. Now, these laws were never meant to solve our biggest problem, which is our sin issue. They were never meant to save us. In these two New Testament scriptures, Jesus says, "Hey, here's what the law says. Here's what the law says about getting along. But I've come to tell you that the law isn't enough any longer. If you want to do more than just get by, if you want to really live, you need to go beyond the law." Jesus says, under the law, you're to love your neighbor. But under the life-giving grace and mercy I am bringing, love even the most difficult people. That's what Jesus says the expectation is. Jesus makes reference to this just a few verses earlier in Matthew 5. He says this, "If you are sued in court and your shirt is taken from you, give your coat too. If a soldier demands that you carry his gear for a mile, carry it 2 miles. Now, to the Jews of Jesus' day, the Roman occupiers were everything that was wrong with their life. The Romans epitomized oppression. We really have no frame of reference in Canada that would give us insight into how the Jewish people felt about living under the Romans. They would wake up every day and see the soldiers occupying their country. They would see Romans taking houses that they wanted just because they could, taking the things that were in those houses as their own possessions just because they could. They were helping themselves to the best of what that country had to offer, caring nothing about the people who owned things, but simply taking what they wanted. Now, the Romans knew that to keep peace with the Jewish people, they would have to handle them very carefully. They wanted the Jews to know who the conquerors were. They wanted the Jews to know who the conquered were. But they also wanted to have the Jewish cooperation. Jesus' reference to carrying a soldier's gear makes reference to a Roman directive that gave a Roman soldier, a Roman citizen, the right to ask any Jew to carry their possessions for 1 mile. The Jews had no choice. If a Roman soldier told you to carry his gear, you had no choice but to pick it up and carry it. But to keep the Jews from protesting too much, the Romans could only demand that the Jews carry their stuff for that 1 mile. Anything longer than that would have been considered abusive. So Jesus' instructions to go a second mile bring up two very important points. First of all, as his followers, we are called to do more than just the minimum when it comes to loving difficult people. We need to do more than the minimum. And secondly, this point reinforces the idea, the truth that if you really want to make the person who's persecuting you mad, be nice to them. Be kind to them. Do something good for them. Scripture says that's like heaping burning coals upon their head. Because Roman soldiers were only permitted to ask you to carry their stuff for 1 mile. If you wanted to really mess with them, what you would do was you would carry it a second mile. Because if their superior found them making you carry it a second mile, they would get in trouble. So you could actually find yourself in an argument with a Roman soldier over his stuff. Him trying to take it from you and you trying to carry it a little farther just to drive him mad. Last week, we looked at two kinds of people that are tough to love, two of the four. Last week, we looked at difficult people, and those people are just really hard to work with. They can be rude. They can be cranky. They can be irresponsible. They can be immature, and we said 1 Corinthians 13:5 gave us the answer. Love is not rude, so I must be tactful, not just truthful. And that people with tact have less to retract. And I'm never persuasive when I'm abrasive. We learned that to love difficult people, we need to be tactful. Then we learned about disappointing people. People that let us down. People that break a trust with us. And it's hard to love those people. And that we're not to be irritable. Love is not irritable, it says. So I must be gentle, not judgmental. And I gave you a little equation that says right plus rude equals wrong. It doesn't matter how right you are. If you are rude when you respond to people, they will not hear you. And this week, we're taking a look at two other types of people that require tough love. And we call it tough love not because it's given harshly. We call it tough love because it's just hard to give love to those people. So third, we're looking at how do we love demanding people? We all know who demanding people are. They have an agenda. They're aggressive. They're pushy. Whenever you're around a demanding person, you feel a little bit manipulated. It's like they want it their way, and they tend to be insistent. They tend to be stubborn. They tend to think they're always right. They can be very self-centered because they're not thinking about anybody else besides themselves. They can be demeaning. It's my way or the highway. Oftentimes, they will expect perfection from you. Demanding people are pushy people. Now, I don't know about you, but when I hear messages about four types of people, I always want to wonder, which type am I? And I think about, is this me? Am I acting this way? Is this the way I behave? And I'm going to be transparent with you. When I get under stress, when I get squeezed too tight, when things are a little too stressful for me, if I'm going to act in a way that's not loving, I'm going to probably act like a demanding person. This is going to be the type of person I act like when I'm not acting like I should. I can be a demanding type person. So how do we love demanding people? There are people who always want their way. There's always got a right way and a wrong way to do things, and their way happens to be the right way. You can never quite please them. This type of person you have to deal with in life, they've got their standards. If you don't meet their standards, they're going to let you know about it. How do you respond in love to demanding people? Well, we looked at 1 Corinthians 13, verse 5. That was our go-to verse last week. It says, love does not demand its own way, so I must be understanding, not demanding. One of the sure signs that our culture is becoming more and more selfish all the time is the push for personal rights and freedoms. Over the last number of years, the push for the rights of individuals has exploded. Individuals have demanded their rights in ways that make no sense whatsoever. Here's an extreme case for you. In April 1995, a man stood accused of four charges of possessing child pornography. A 65-year-old divorced father of two from Surrey represented himself in court in the case. He argued the prohibition against the possession of child pornography was an infringement of his right to freedom, freedom of conscience under the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. Rights and freedoms is now the excuse for people to behave badly. Kids say, you can't touch me, no matter what I do, because I have my rights. Adults say, you can't tell me how to live, because I have my rights. Demanding people know how to push and manipulate and bully. Jesus was a master at dealing with demanding people. Philippians 5, 2-7. Your attitude should be the same that Jesus Christ had, though he was God. He did not demand and cling to his rights as God. He made himself nothing. He took the humble position of a slave and appeared in human form. Jesus was God. He could have demanded anything from anyone at any time. But instead, he was understanding. When he came in contact with demanding people, when we come in contact with demanding people, we often try and argue and convince them. We try and convince them how wrong they are. We try and convince them how unreasonable they are behaving, only to find out that they're unreasonable and they don't listen. And you can't change them. We try and find creative ways to get through to them. Or we try and do it our own way, not God's way. And we become equally demanding and pushy. Loving, demanding people God's way runs counter to our culture. If you or the group you represent feels oppressed, put down, or marginalized, the culture says, demand your rights, stand up for yourself, get what's yours. And Christians can point the finger at the world and tisk, tisk, tisk them. But one of the most vocal and in-your-face voices in the world today are Christians who claim they are being pushed around. Many Christ followers will shout long and loud about how they feel they're being put down, pushed aside, and swept aside by other groups who are very loud and organized. The problem is we are trying to fight demanding people by being demanding people, and that doesn't work. Love does not demand its own way. We need to respond to demanding people with understanding. Well, how do you be more understanding of people who are demanding and pushy in your life? Well, by getting a new perspective on their life. The more you understand about a person and their situation, the better you're going to be able to relate to them. You see, I'm impatient with people I don't understand. But when I know them and I know them well, I'm going to know what I call the three B's. We need to know the three B's, their background, their battles, and their burdens. When you know what demanding people are going through, when you know what they're struggling with, you have a much better chance of understanding them. We often look at people and say, oh man, look how far they have to go. Man, oh man, they got a lot of work to do. That one's got a lot of work to do in their life. But we don't stop and say, I wonder how far they've come. I wonder what they've already been through. Maybe they were raised in a family where they were taught to be demanding. They were taught to demand their own rights. Maybe they weren't taught to be compassionate. Maybe they weren't shown a model of courtesy. Maybe they grew up in a very dysfunctional home, and they've come so far. We should acknowledge that. We always look at how far they've got to go. We don't look at how far they've come. So look at their background. Look at their burdens. What are the problems they're carrying? They may be sick. They may have a temperature. The reason they're so irritable, there might be something going on in their lives. One of the things that, one of the first things we taught new people who came to join us when we hired them at Shoppers Drug Mart was, you're going to meet people that are having some of the worst days of their lives. They've just come from the doctor. They've just been told they have terminal cancer. They're coming to the pharmacy to get a prescription. You'll have to be understanding and understand that they're going through a really rough time. They might be a little bit cranky today. Their child has just been diagnosed with meningitis. They might be coming to the store a little bit stressed, a little bit anxious. Be understanding of that. We need to have the same idea and the same attitude. Love is understanding, not demanding. Now, does that mean I'm just supposed to let demanding people walk all over me? Somebody who is a demanding person, do I just let them push me around? Do I act like a doormat? Do I cave in and say, whatever you want? No. Here's the key. Be tender without surrender. You don't let people just push you around. Jesus never caved in to manipulators. The Pharisees and the Sadducees and the religious leaders, they were always trying to push Jesus, manipulate Jesus, twist his words. They were extremely demanding. They were very legalistic. They had all kinds of demands that they themselves couldn't even keep. Jesus would not let demanding people push him into a corner. Be tender without surrender. That's what you call love in action. Now, while the first three tough love candidates can all say they don't understand what they're doing, they may not realize how they're behaving, this final group is fully aware of their behavior and its outcome. These are destructive people. These people want to harm you. They are intentional. It's sad to say, but there is evil in the world, and there are hateful people, and there are people who want to hurt. They want to injure. Some of them are double dealing. They're deceitful. They mean us harm. They can be deadly. They can be disingenuous. They can be dangerous. They can be debilitating. But they're in your life. The destructive people, the ones who hurt you, the ones who wound you, the ones who harm you. How do we love destructive people? Surely God can't expect us to love somebody who is purposely out to harm us. When people hurt us, we have two natural tendencies, two things that we do in general. First of all, we remember it. We stockpile it in our minds, in our memories. We put it back in that database back there somewhere and say, I'm never forgetting that one. I'm never letting that one go. I'm never letting them off the hook for that. I'm going to watch them. From now on, we remember it. We rehearse it over and over. Or we retaliate. We get even. But our verse says, love keeps no record of wrongs. Love says you don't repeat it, you delete it. But we repeat these things in our lives. We give these things a rehash in our minds on a regular basis. And we repeat the hurts that have been done to us in three ways. First of all, we repeat it emotionally in our minds. We rehash it and we repeat it to ourselves. When we hold on to those hurts and repeat them in our minds, we do damage to ourselves. Bitterness will begin to grow in your life. There'll be something, a seed, a root down there that will begin to grow. And anger and resentment will take hold in our lives. It becomes an emotional and spiritual deformity. What do you call those things that grow around the thing on the tree? Where's Dave Kerner? What do you call that thing? A burl. A burl. Yeah, a burl covers up an airborne virus that hits the tree. And the tree begins to grow this big, ugly, knotted thing around it. And we have resentment and bitterness in our lives. Things begin to grow in our lives. We become paralyzed, immobilized, and ineffective in all areas of our life. Leviticus 19:17 says, "Do not bear a grudge against others, but settle your differences with them so you will not commit a sin because of them." Well, how do I commit a sin against someone by holding a grudge? How does something sinful happen in my life because of a grudge? Psychology study after psychology study has proven this to be true. Whatever you rehearse, you begin to resemble. Whatever you rehearse, you begin to resemble. I like to golf. I like to golf with people who don't cheat. Not mentioning any names. Fred. Pro golfers have this mental imagery that they go through when they're about to play a round of golf. They go through every shot at every hole in their mind. They actually sit and think about every shot they're going to take. And they always end with a successful putt to finish the hole. And the reason they rehearse that, the reason that they do that is because they know that if they see it enough times, then they can make it happen. What they look at, what they see in their mind is what's going to happen. They practice, they rehearse watching themselves make the winning putt. Because what we rehearse in our minds is what we will become. Whatever you think about the most, that's what you move toward. And see, that mental imagery can be positive in the case of a golfer. It can be negative if we hold resentment. We move toward whatever we think about. If all you think about is how much you've been hurt in the past, you're going to move towards the past. If you focus on the future, you move towards the future. If you focus on the promises of God, you move toward the promises of God. If you focus on potential, you move towards potential. But if you focus on your pain, you're moving towards your pain. Whatever you rehearse, you will eventually begin to resemble. This past Wednesday, our connection group had the opportunity to help out at Fields of Faith, where they cook and serve food to people who are generally homeless or in poverty. And so we spent last Wednesday evening a few hours down at George Little Park serving spaghetti and noodles and sandwiches to people. And some of us went to Zion Baptist Church and made the food ahead of time. And I didn't have any food to serve, so I was just kind of there hanging out with people, talking to people. And somebody said, "Hey, Pastor Mel, can you come pray with this fellow?" And this guy had come up, and he was really quiet and didn't really want to approach anybody for the food. And I wasn't sure if he'd been around before, if he was new, but apparently everybody knew who he was. And he was a man probably, I don't know, his mid-30s. He was drunk. And I got to hear a little bit of his story. He was raped by his family as a child repeatedly, and then they took him out of his home and sent him to foster care, and he was raped by his foster parents and raped by his uncle, and just a horrible, horrible story. And one of the people there was praying with him and talking to him about forgiveness and how he needed to forgive, and he said, I don't want to be this way. I don't want to act this way. I can't tell my wife why I'm doing what I'm doing, and struggle with addiction and alcohol and can't get free of it. And he says, I know I'm a child of God, and I just can't get away from this. And every time he came around to the same thing, he was so bitter and angry at his family for how they treated him. Now, I have no idea what that man went through. I have no idea how difficult that was. I have no idea how painful his circumstances were. But the people there that were caring for them all told him the same thing. Until you're willing to let that go, you will never, ever, ever be free of that addiction because you're trying to fight that pain with that alcohol. And that cannot work. And he knows it can't work. He said, it's not working. It's not working. But he's not ready to let go of the anger and the bitterness. People say, I will never be like my father. I will never be like my mother. I will never, I will never, I will never. Guess what? You're moving towards that. You're moving towards that. The very fact that you're focused on it means that's what you're moving toward. When you hold on to resentment, you do not damage the person who hurt you, but you do plenty of damage to yourself. Resentment only perpetuates the pain. It never heals anything. It never takes care of anything. So we repeat it when we go over it in our minds. Secondly, we repeat it in fights in our relationships. Married folks, have you ever noticed that when you have an argument with your spouse, their memory improves instantly? The person who could not remember to bring home milk and toilet paper the day before can remember exactly what you said 15 years ago to the letter. Yep. We all do it. It's not right. That's not how love acts. Proverbs 17:9. Love forgets mistakes. Nagging about them parts the best of friends. Can I get an amen? That was all men, I think. Some of you in your marriages have been hurt by a partner in a major way, an unfaithfulness, a disloyalty. Or some of your other important relationships with a pastor or a church leader maybe, or with a parent. Some kind of thing that really hurts you, but they came back and they said, I'm sorry. They wanted forgiveness. Will you forgive me? And they've stayed with you and they've stuck with you. And you've said, I forgive you, but I'm not ever, ever going to forget what you did. Back there in the back of your mind, you keep repeating it. No matter what they do good, it's never enough. Because you've got this list of things against them. All the times they've disappointed you and all the ways they've been destructive in your life. In your mind, there's a scale with all the good things and with all the bad things. And the good things never outweigh the bad because you've got your thumb on the bad side of the scale and you keep weighing it down. I'll say this tactfully, but truthfully. If that's you, you're killing your relationship. It's not the big sin that's killing the relationship. It's the fact that you won't let it go. As a result, you've become unpleasable. Another way we repeat it is we repeat it to other people. We repeat it in our own minds. We repeat it in fights in our relationships. And we repeat it to other people. We talk to others about it. That's called gossip. We tell everybody else about it. We don't talk to God about it. We talk to everybody else about it. We want to try to line up people on our side. We want people to hate that person as much as we do. So we try and gather support for our case. Proverbs 16:28 is very clear about gossip. It says, gossip is spread by wicked people who stir up trouble and break up friendships. Every time I share some gossip, I'm wicked. Did you get that? Did you know that God hates gossip? Absolutely hates it. He hates it as much as he hates pride because that's what gossip is. Gossip is pure and simple ego. Raw, bald-faced, unadulterated ego. The only reason people gossip is to make themselves feel superior over somebody else. I know something about somebody else that makes them look bad and me feel good. One of the greatest tests of your love is how much you gossip. You see, unloving people love to gossip. You shouldn't tell other people about the hurt. You talk to God about the hurt. You tell him how you're hurt. You tell him about that person. You tell him about that pain. Mark 11:25 says, whenever you stand praying, if you have anything against anyone, forgive him and let it drop. Leave it, let it go, in order that your Father who is in heaven may also forgive you and your own failing and shortcomings, and let them drop. It says, don't repeat it, delete it. Don't repeat it to yourself, not to the one who hurt you, and not to other people either. But pastor, it's been too long. I've held on to this my entire life. I've held on to that hurt for years and years, maybe decades. It's just too late. No, you're wrong. It says, hate stirs up trouble, but love forgives all offenses. If you want to keep trouble in your life, just keep stirring up that discord. Just keep stirring up that hate in your life. If you want to compound your trouble, then hold on to your hurt. Which of the all in all offenses have you not let go? Now, I want to be clear. Some of us, some of you have had awful hurts done to you, awful, painful things happen in your life. I am not trying to minimize those things. I'm not saying those things didn't happen. Some of you have been hurt by a teacher, an aunt, an uncle, a pastor, a parent, a sibling. The Bible says there will be severe judgment for child abuse, for child neglect, for child abandonment. One day God is going to settle the score. There's no doubt about that. When God says honor your father and mother, he's not saying honor their mistakes. He's not saying honor the abuse. He's not saying honor those painful things. He's not saying ignore the pain in your life and put on a happy face and pretend everything's great. No, not at all. So what does God expect? He doesn't expect you to ignore it. He doesn't expect you to pretend it doesn't exist. He's not asking you to gloss over it or deny it or repress it. He's not expecting you to fake it or make excuses for the people who hurt you in your life. In fact, God doesn't want you to fake it at all. He doesn't want you to fake it. He wants you to face it. You cannot forgive until you face it. You cannot forgive someone until you face it. You'll never be free until you forgive, and you'll never forgive until you face it. Some of us were hurt immensely as children. There's unfinished business. If you're going to become the loving woman of God, the loving man of God that God wants you to be, you're going to have to deal with these past issues. The truth is, you're carrying around a burden. You're carrying around a burden that causes you to lash out at people. You lash out at your wife. You lash out at your kids. You lash out at your friends. And they're not the ones that caused you the pain. And they have no understanding as to why you do that. Don't allow that anymore. You got to deal with the anger. You got to face it before you can forgive. Proverbs 19:11 says this, when someone wrongs you, it is a great virtue to ignore it. You got to let it go. But you cannot let it go until you face it, until you deal with it with God.